Now, some, I mean, I'll try to fill gaps that were left over from the last meeting. Now, did you speak with Weitz von Rassen?
No, not much. I talked with Weitz von Rassen.
Yes, that you told me.
And occasionally, of course, occasionally, you'd quote Russian remarks. No, I talked English. He used to repeat what Russians said to him before the war in Russia and so on. His Russian was not very good.
But let's say...
Look, he spoke to the before. He spoke every language with a Yiddish accent.
I know.
Every language.
I know. Nice voice and a Yiddish accent. Yes. Yes. Very nice voice.
And he only talked Russian to me when he wanted to talk in code on the telephone. When he talked about Stephen Weiss, he said the sage in Russian. Weiss, that kind of thing.
I see. Mm. Now, had he known better Russian, I get the impression that when somebody knows Russian, you prefer to speak Russian.
I do. I enjoy it very much. I do it so seldom. But if I can do it, I like doing it.
I even thought that some friendships you developed because of Russian.
Might be true, but I wonder if it is true.
By the way, Nabokov spoke Russian or English?
Russian. He spoke English perfectly.
And you spoke it in Russian?
Yes, for the most part. Sometimes English, but... Well, I mean, of course, but Russian is. Mainly Russian.
And,
but I would have made friends with Nabokov anyway, in any language.
All right.
But of course there is a factor.
Yeah.
It was a factor. Yeah. It was a factor. I'm trying to think who I took Russian to whom I would otherwise... I mean, I'm in particularly good terms with the wife of Francis Haskell in Oxford. Of course, she's Soviet Russian. And we talk Russian and it irritates everybody else. I used to talk to Lydia Keynes. Keynes' wife was a Russian ballerina.
Yes.
In Russian.
I knew she was ballerina, I didn't know she was Russian.
Pure, yes, Lopukhova was her name, and it used to annoy Keynes. It's always annoyed people when people speak some other language they can't understand.
Yes, and...
When Aline talks French, I don't understand a word.
Really?
On telephone, no? Well, more or less. I exaggerate, but on the whole, not.
And
I don't listen.
The Pasternak sisters in Oxford.
Russian,
of course. And Stravinsky, you met...
Russian. Except in company, but otherwise Russian. Certain. And Stravinsky's wife, more particularly Russian, certainly.
I remember once in Jerusalem, I saw you speaking Russian with Shmuel Leitinger.
Certainly.
Which means you prefer to speak.
I like it.
You like it.
I like it. I enjoy it. I enjoy it because it's a language which is quite close to me, and I can say things in it which I cannot say in English.
That's what I wanted to ask.
But it's true of all languages. Any language is a window through which cuts reality differently from another language. Hebrew and English are not the same. What you say in Hebrew, you will not say in English. The emphasis is different. The world is somewhat... transformed.
You mean that you can say things in Russian that you can't say in English, but not all the things, I mean, that, and there are things that you can say in English and can't say in Russian or what?
Not too simple. The world feels different between speaking one language and another. You cut the things differently. I mean, the shape of the universe about which you speak is transformed by the language which you apply to it.
But, I mean, except English, is Russian the language you feel freer than any other form?
Certain. I don't feel free in any other form.
That's what you thought. So,
I don't speak German or French or Italian or Hebrew at all well. I can't conduct conversation for any length of time. I'm really not gifted languages. People think I must be, but I'm not. I'm not.
No. That's in a way a personal question.
Yes, by all means.
When the new Jewish immigrants came to Israel in the 70s,
yes,
right, en masse, I was terribly disappointed.
Yes.
I mean, my mother came from Russia. All her friends were Russian. The family. I had a certain
image
in mind. And they were so
different. Quite different, exactly.
Of course, now we know because of two generations of Bolshevik regime and everything. But it was shocking.
It was to everybody that.
Now, I was going to ask. I mean, you were also...
I didn't meet many of them. I met one or two or three. But, and I talked to them. Yes, I wasn't shocked because I expected it.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
They were aggressive. They were very reactionary,
very
the right wing, very materialistic, and they come, yes.
Exactly the opposite type of the Russian we were used.
Well, of course, the whole idea of Russian Jews was that these were decent liberal Jews who were oppressed by the Soviet regime, one of the countries in which they could have decent democracy and kind of quiet life. Not at all. They all voted for Begin as one man. Because
not
the word, well, not anymore now, no. The word democracy, the word socialism was a dirty word.
Yeah. And they were in a way neurotics because they were not used to make decisions. I mean, in Russia, you don't
No,
make
but
decisions.
I mean, all these jokes are made, but a man makes a tailor who makes a suit, he expected the state to take it from his hands.
Yeah.
The idea that you have to wait for the customer. He's unheard of. I mean, they didn't know how to react.
And we didn't expect that to be a real psychological problem for them. I mean, to come to a country where you have to decide 100 decisions a day, what kind of bread to buy. And that made them...
It's very funny that the Israeli embassy didn't tell you. They could have known.
They could have known.
It shows great insensitivity on their
maybe,
part.
Maybe the people who dealt with that didn't know. I didn't.
Nor did they.
I mean, a man like Benjamin Eliyahu,
nobody warned you.
You know.
What?
That we were not warned.
No. Clearly not. Nobody ever said it. When they met Jews in Russia, they talked to them about Jewish problems, about anti-Semitism, about synagogue, about Israel. They didn't talk about daily lives.
Very interesting. Now, you told me that you met only few. Is it because you didn't take interest in it? Or
No. Purely accidentally.
Sure?
Quite sure.
Because
I was not,
they are not nice.
I was not repelled by them. No. I was not repelled by them. I was not repelled. I mean, after my two elderly relations came out of Russia.
Yes, that's another story.
They were rather old.
Yes.
They were exactly what I expected.
Yes, all right. I mean, that's a relation.
They were shaped by old-fashioned Jewish life in Russia.
That's the point. I mean, are you sure that you didn't have some inhibition?
No, none at all. If I had met them, I would have talked to them. I didn't know what I was... No, none. I was never thrown into sufficient contact with Jews from Russia to be able to form that kind of negative opinion.
You see, I remember...
I know it's true, because people said that to me. I didn't come across it.
I remember once in Santa Margarita, in the beach, we were there, you and me, Emma Lynn, and I think Herbert, and there was there a young lady having a bus, and she came from Milan or something, and it turned out to be that she was just out of Vilna or something, and I saw that you were not intrigued.
No.
It was 70.
No, I would have been, but I'm too shy. I can't enter the conversation with strangers. I wouldn't have minded at all.
Yes, I see, but you wouldn't have minded, but you were not taken by it. You were not...
I knew what to expect.
Yes.
I knew as they speak. I know what they're like. I have a very clear idea what they're like. I don't feel in the least unsympathetic, but I don't feel deeply sympathetic either. I mean, it's...
I saw it and I understood it. I mean,
no more than with American Jews or any other Jews. Jews are Jews, and of course, I'm drawn to them. But it doesn't excite me to meet someone who was in Riga 5 years ago. Because they're perfectly normal. They happen to have these particular qualities of not being able to decide and having rather right-wing views and this. Otherwise, they're exactly like what I expect.
There are so much realists.
I know.
Really, it's... many are rather intelligent, I mean, but... yes, all right. Now... you said, by the way, did you speak Russian with Edmund?
But when I talk to Brodsky, for example, I feel lips in no barrier.
All right.
But still, he was born there.
Yes, all right.
Quite late.
Yes.
More at ease of years.
Did you speak Russian with Edmund Wilson?
No.
No.
No, he used various Russian expressions and so on. No, no, certainly not.
Did you speak Russian with Max Heiberg?
Well, only as a kind of joke, but regularly, not normally. No, I did not. I took Russian to Katkov.
I mean, literally.
Normally. I took Russian to Katkov. I took Russian to a lady called Nyuta Kalina, who is the founder of the third program, who is a Moscow Jewess.
Nyuta
was her name. Kalina was her name.
So many friends of my mother.
We were called Nyuta. Anyuta, it comes from Anna. Anna was her name. She was a straight Russian Jewess, lived in Berlin and in England, was a high-grade intellectual who created the...
The third program?
Yeah, the talks.
Really?
Not the music, but the talks. Absolutely.
And the music is Hans Keller?
She produced... Music was Hans Keller, yes. She produced the talks, she trained Toynbee when he had delivered his lectures. She was a great expert. I talked to her in Russian.
Well, I don't know whether I told you, but I think that the best breed of modern Jews are Russians who were educated in Germany.
It always was so.
Yes.
It always, but the Russians of the 19th century were some of the most civilized people in the world. And some of the Jews have taken on that color, too.
And then add to it the German education.
Something abroad. Yeah. But Nabokov, you see, who left Russia at the age of 1819, quite. Well, went to Berlin first.
Yes.
And then to Paris. Hence, he was all right.
There were many.
Perfect. Vladimir Nabokov, a novelist, his first cousin, the same thing.
And among the Jewish leaders, I mean, Motsky.
Max Hayward was much more like a Soviet citizen than he was like an Englishman in some ways.
I know.
In some ways.
Yes.
More at home among those sort of people.
Yeah, when I read Patricia Black's, did you read Patricia Black's introduction to...
Oh, certainly I was deeply offended and made a violent protest.
Why?
Because she misrepresented me in a very horrifying way.
Mm-hmm.
Not to the S.
To
two or three passages which were totally false, which my Max Hayward must have communicated. But he was an awful liar, Max Hayward. He wasn't truthful. Well, I'll tell you. Well, why should I repeat them now?
No,
I'm trying to remember. Wait a minute. One was about... I remember one about Katkov in particular. But the one about Max Hayward himself. Yes, that he came to dinner with me in New College. In New College, at the high table. And I talked to David Sissel, who was there also, somebody else. And he... alleged that it's simply terrible to hear all this patter by all these so-called civilized people, all this trivial talk between all these, these snobbish characters, so to speak, nothing real, and so on. That covers it. He probably did say it. It wasn't terribly necessary to report it. That from the thing which I objected to was, for example, because he was very nice to me, Max Hayward, in the last days, and kept on begging me to come to his death cell.
Yes.
And brought him presents and so on. I know.
And
he was very respectful to him. He had registered some respect for me. But this is what he must have said to Patricia Blake at some point. She's a nasty girl. Yes. She was Nabokov's third wife.
Was
she? Yes. That's how I met her. Forgive me.
Yes.
Which one, please?
Well,
Yes. I was telling about the second thing which I minded, and that is that Katkoff reported to Miss Blake, that when I brought Zhivago with me from Moscow, and he said that it must be translated immediately. I said, no, it doesn't matter. I mean, whether it's translated now, translated later, doesn't make any difference. Nobody will read it in that degree of hurry. There's absolutely no need to fuss about that or to get it published, either in Russian or in English. That's a total lie. I mean, the whole idea of bringing it out was it should be looked after, so to speak. Not necessarily published, because I thought that might do him harm, but in fact, I knew it was going to be published in Italy. So all this business about what is it matter this year, next year, is what he said. I said, I telephoned him and said, did you really say that? He said, I'm very old, very feeble, I'm very old. Maybe I did. Maybe I didn't say that to you. Maybe not. Oh, I don't think you did, no. No, I may have told her that, yes. And maybe. But he was very angry with me because I said that to broadcast bits of Zhivago over the Russian service, he would use it as propaganda, would do Pasternak harm. I may have been wrong, but I thought it was very, very bad. Very bad to exploit it. So we had a certain disagreement. But anyway, she put all that in and made me look in a very bad light in all kinds of ways. Yeah. If you look at it again, you'll find it. So I remember that introduction extremely well. He did have an affair with a certain Max. Patricia, yes. Certainly. And with lots of other people, but particularly with her. He had much nicer mistresses whom I knew. Not at all. She's a tough journalist of a ruthless, self, so to speak, pushing kind. Everything she does is calculated. There's no spontaneity of behavior.
I see. By the way, Max's attachment to Jews and Judaism was
extraordinary.
I know he knew many Jews, I know he knew...
No, but all the same, all the same. Partly Israel, more than Jews.
Yes,
because Israel was anti-Soviet. Let me tell you, it's not irrelevant. I don't think he had many friendships among Jews as such.
You mean Max?
Yeah.
But in New York he did.
Because of his... In New York only about people on the anti-Soviet front.
He wasn't
saved there, Only anti-Soviet Jews. Only, I don't think any others. I mean, people had some relation to Russia. What other Jews can you produce for him?
I don't know, but... it doesn't look like that being the only motive.
I mean, in a way, though, that... No, it's not the only motive. But when they felt quite... But people liked him, you see. But the sort of people who liked him among Jews, or people took an interest in his field, in his attitude.
And in Leeds he had Jewish friends, in his youth. I remember when I was a student in Oxford, in 1961, or possibly when I came for my sabbatical in 1973, he had one Saturday guest, from Leeds, and he invited Batya and myself and George Katkov, and it was a certain Gillinson from Leeds.
I knew Gillinson.
Gillinson is a well active Jew.
Gillinson was the head of the community.
Yeah. And he came to see Max?
He was head of the Jewish community, and he took an interest in the university. He was a Zionist.
Yeah.
All that. I once delivered a lecture in Leeds under his auspices. I remember Gillinson. Yes, and he was a came to see Max. So
it means he had probably some other ties. Patricia Blake is a Jew.
Of course. Her real name must be Schwartz. Blake.
Yes, but she's... Yes, it was Schwartz. She said Blake, and they wrote Blake. She writes it Blake.
Blake.
Yeah, I mean, I have a story about it, but it's...
No interest. She works in Time magazine, very properly. Very anti-Israel paper. It is.
I don't read it now.
Nor do I, but Time, what, Time magazine.
By the way, I heard it on the radio that since the riots started in Israel 10 weeks ago, the New Statesman didn't mention it.
How extraordinary. Very odd. Surprising. Surprising and disturbing. There's a woman who always writes about Israel for it. What is her name? Naomi Shepherd.
Well, if they want report, they would ask her for a report.
Quite.
And The Economist wrote in a very, very...
friendly way, I know.
Friendly, disappointed.
Yes, yes, yes.
Very
well, the Times, is the leading articles are straightforwardly pro-Israel.
You have your interpretation.
Yes.
I mean, except the Independent, I think that most dailies are
more pro-Israel, more we think. Yes. They should be.
The Guardian, know. The best reports are the Guardian.
But the Guardian is very anti-Israel.
Yes, but the reports are very, very
by different. Whom? By whom?
By Ian Blake, who knows Arabic, knows Hebrew.
I'm very glad to hear it.
The best person.
But the leading articles are probably critical.
Yeah, that I didn't see. But the coverage is excellent. And, all right. Now, you said that Weizmann would be left of center, or was left of center.
Yes.
I think that your interpretation is a little bit
wrong.
I tell you what I think. He liked Hashomer HaTzair. He liked Nahalal, who were Hapoel HaTzair. Because they were not activists, Democrats, but Hapoel HaTzair would be, they were the less socialists among the socialists, and he liked them. Which means his attachment to the, let's say, Hashomer HaTzair and Hapoel HaTzair was because of their moderate way in Zionism.
No, yes, of course.
And
yes.
Constructive way.
Yeah. All right. All right.
Secondly, in the 30s, he developed the Labour Party as his allies.
Quite.
You know, after 31, there are some moving letters to Ben Gurion, Bel Katzenelson, and I think Springzak. Our alliance was for me the rock of Gibraltar.
Very good.
He repeats it and repeats it.
Yeah.
And they were allies in developing the concept of parité, to avoid the legislative council.
Yeah, quite.
And to be able to prevent the idea of Jewish state.
But look, you're talking about political issues. That is not what I mean.
One second. I think he became against Ben-Gurion.
But for obvious reasons.
When it was personal.
Entirely.
So, I mean, but his ideas, he was not...
You're talking in terms of political opinions. That is not what I mean when I say left of center.
So what
I mean is something quite different. Temperamentally, Weizmann was a man who liked, roughly speaking, what might be called the Jewish people as such. What he didn't like was the superior groups of Western Jews who saw themselves as an elite of any kind. He really didn't like them at all. I mean, he used them, and he flattered them, and he got money out of them, and he got professors to come to Israel from them, but he didn't like them as... What he liked was what he was brought up among, as we all do. He liked what might be called the mass. The Jewish masses meant something to him. And the Jewish masses meant the great Yiddish-speaking masses, Eastern Europe. That's who Israel was meant to be for. He didn't much care whether German Jews came or not. Unless, of course, they would help, because they were experts and they were important for the development of Israel. But if no German Jews came as German Jews. This wouldn't hurt him. The idea was immigration of warm-hearted populism is what I mean. And he felt best among these kind of people, to whom in the end he could talk Yiddish. That's what I mean. Brandeis was exactly what he didn't like. Quite apart from the difference of view. When he made that famous remark, evidently there's no bridge between Pinsk and Washington, is what he said. The bridge was not just a tactical bridge or bridge as far as the ideas about how to develop Israel. The bridge was personal, emotional. The outlooks were different. And when he thought of Israel as a country for Jews, the kind of Jews he meant were the children. The children, the healthily brought up children of the kind of Russian Jews he knew. Even Jabotinsky was preferable to Brandeis.
I'm sure. I mean, if you say East European Jews, I agree. And even the Jew of Poland, all right.
Oh, yes?
But I don't think he was a populist because, I mean, and here we come to the difference between him and Jabotinsky. He, because of his political attitude toward the way of building the shul, he wanted Chalutzim to come.
Yes, he did.
And not the masses.
No, but I
and
mean...
Chalutzim was already a sort of elitist attitude of a different type.
No.
He even said... I mean,
he may have said it, that the Chalutzim were members of the masses, socially.
Yes, socially they were members.
That's all I mean.
You see, because there are...
That's all I mean.
In the 30s,
yes.
When he had... I mean, when there were good years of mass immigration, he said, I don't want the scum of the earth of East Europe to come.
No, of course not. No. Terrible phrase. No, of course he didn't want the Mecklers. He didn't want the...
Never appeal to him demagogically. That Jabotinsky did.
No, he always had, like I know. He had an image of, so to speak, idealistic young Zionists with gifted, who would become scientists, who would become developers.
It would be the bridgehead to the masses, all right.
Yes. But the people they sprang from, he did not mind Balabatim. What he did mind was what he regarded as a corrupt mass of commercial Jews, so to speak, who had no basis to them, were all crooks and operators and managers of this and managers of that, whom he had nothing in common. No, but that's what I mean. What he did not want was cultivate the elites. You see? Because that wouldn't have built a country for him. That is not what immigrants were made of. His image of Israel was a kind of what Russia might have become without the revolution, without Lenin, so to speak, a kind of democracy of people with Russian Jewish feelings.
But he never joined a labor movement.
Because he hated political parties. Okay. He joined no movement.
Political basis was the general...
He had no politics.
No, I know, but...
Never mind, the basis was pragmatic. Whatever worked, from his point of view.
This was his mistake.
Maybe, but he was...
Because in the 30s, he lost his grip, and he lost his touch with the general...
He had no political views.
And Ben-Gurion didn't...
He did not have political views. Political programs meant nothing to him. That's the point. Just intellectual issues meant nothing to him.
That's in the period Union.
Of course. Earlier, maybe it might have been the case.
Earlier, he was political minded.
No, but he didn't think in terms of political programs. He thought in terms of the sort of structure of the country, structure of the... All he wanted really was what Herzl wanted, what all these people wanted, which was a sort of European-style democracy.
And yet he conceptualized the alternative to Weizmann on the one hand and to Ahadam on the other. And I mean, the concept of constructive, practical Zionism.
Yes.
I mean, integrated Zionism as against political Zionism of Herzl.
Yes.
Or spiritual Zionism of Sahadar.
No, no, that is too simple.
The articulation of Weizmann.
That's too simple, what you're saying. Simplifies the issue too much. He was against the political concept of Herzl. It's only a question of means. Yes. How we get the country. Yes. So it's only a question of methods, but not the question of some kind of political ideal. Herzl's political ideal was the French Third Republic, roughly. You see, he just wanted an ordinary, civilized Western state. Herzl wasn't what people like Chomsky and Trevor Roper maintained. There wasn't a kind of element of hysterical nationalism or semi-fascism. That's not true. He wanted something like the Third Republic, England, France. That's what all bourgeois Jews admired. Holland. He liked Nachadam, and Nachadam liked him. And Nachadam crowned him, as you know, told him to become head of the movement over the head of all the important people, like Sokolov and Shtenov, so on. But they got on. But he thought that Nachadam's idea was not a state at all, it's some kind of spiritual center, meant nothing to him. And rightly not. There's nothing in it.
Discussing the Hadam, I believe, and if you read Weizmann carefully, that he admired the Hadam to the last day.
That is right.
And that psychologically, he felt as a disciple who ought to rebel. And I can tell you even more than that. I believe that the majority of the Zionist leaders of the generation of Weizmann, all of whom in a way rebelled against Hadam, went on until the last day of their life arguing with him internally.
No, I understand that. No, Hadam had a very powerful influence,
yes,
because he was the most Jewish thinker of that time, of course.
And he raised issues that were right painful. All along.
Yes, and painful too.
And painful.
Oh, yes.
Three major issues.
The Arabs.
That we tried to put their
what? The Arabs was number
the
one.
Arabs, the relations between Israel and the diaspora.
Yes.
And the place of religion in Israel.
Quite so. All of which are central.
All the major
central
issues
what Weizmann liked about Aram, apart from respecting him personally as a man of integrity and vision, was that Achadam wanted a Jewish people to live a Jewish life without oppression by their rabbis, without rabbinical, without theocracy, you see? And that Weizmann believed in, because Weizmann wanted to be a Jew among Jews. He did not want assimilation. Apart from the political need for a state, he didn't like assimilation as such.
Oh, yes.
And that's what Achadam was the only non-rabbinical intellectual alternative to assimilation. You see? I mean, Nehemia, after was so close to Weizmann, was entirely pro-assimilation. But he wanted a Jewish state, in which a lot of assimilated Jews would create a splendid Jewish state, but they would all have to get rid of all this rabbinical nonsense.
Yes.
Jewish tradition meant nothing to him. You see? What he wanted to state, because he wanted to cease to be ashamed of being a Jew. You see? And they wanted to be proud and stand up and have a proper political life like anybody else. That's like other nations.
Like
no,
other nations.
Normality. Normalization. Anybody else? Normalization. That's right. Normalization. Masaryk is what he wanted. Exactly. Yes, yes, yes. He thought Sokolov was like Masaryk, and quite admired him, in spite of Weizmann's objections, you see. But fundamentally what Sokolov wanted was exactly what Weizmann wanted.
Oh, yes.
Personally, it was the ideals were the same.
By far.
Yes. Same. Shlyanov, the same. Yes. Russian Zionists said, were on the whole, solidarity. The only difference was tactics. Their ideals, Edelson, the brothers Goldberg, it's all exactly the same. The same thing.
Later.
The same thing.
Yeah. Oh, they were all alone.
We had something of that in him.
Nothing
different.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Just that. He just wanted to be a Jew.
That for sure.
They all want to be Jews. Nehemiah did not want to be a Jew. That's another matter.
Oh, yes. I agree with you.
Nature wanted goification of an independent Jewish state.
He could well have become a revisionist.
He could, yes. But he wouldn't because he couldn't, because he would have thought that it's not practical.
Oh, right.
He was too English for that.
That's
he believed in English methods.
But that's the only thing. Otherwise, there was in Jabotinsky
some common element.
This kind of thing.
Certainly. Officers and gentlemen.
The impact of Italy on Jabotinsky.
Nehemiah didn't want officers, but he wanted gentlemen. He wasn't the one himself, but he admired them.
Yes. Speaking about the Haggadah, British Zionists were taken by Haggadah. Leon Simon, Ben Fritsch, this generation. Did you? Were you taken by him? Did you read Haggadah?
No. I didn't read Hebrew very well. And I didn't, it's even, of course I read Benfitch's. I had no great respect for Achadam. That's the trouble. Yes, because I thought that all the stuff about Moses and Spencer and God knows what seemed to me stale 19th century sociology. I respected him as a figure because he was steeped in Jewish values. He was a man brought up brave, morally courageous, penetrating about Jewish issues, but the philosophy of Haggadah was for me not a philosophy.
For Zionist intellectuals, but who were not educated in philosophy, he was...
I know. So, just as Masaryk was for Jews. Like Masaryk. Exactly. Wonderful. For me, it was second-rate liberal, decent liberal attitudes. Plus psychologism, a little bit of influence, a little bit by religious modernism.
Yeah,
of people who said it didn't matter whether Christ lived or not. The important thing is the myth of Christ. Moses doesn't matter where he lived. For us, he must exist.
No, it was before Freud. So,
it was before Freud. Spencer. Which nobody read, you see.
But he did.
Certain.
I know, it's
without doubt. It's Spencer, probably Kant, Spencer.
He read Spencer for sure.
I know he did. Kant. I know he did, Spencer, yes. And he probably read, I don't know who would have been the sort of people in the Russian intelligentsia read in these days. Mill, Spencer, maybe Carlyle.
He read English well.
I know. Maybe Carlyle, Emerson, whom Bialik read. You see, right, and those sort of people. They're just decent liberal writers.
Yes, yes. Now.
But I agree with the Jewish non-philosophers, this was kind of Westernism, which excited them.
And as a young boy in high school, I admired Haggadah.
I understand that very well.
But then, later, there were much deeper Jewish thinkers. Nachman Krochmal, Berdichevsky, they were much different.
Probably. Haggadah was a very admirable figure.
Who?
He was an admirable figure.
Haggadah?
Yes. That is the point. He was sitting in England, agent of some tea company, Wysotsky. Yes. And he dedicated himself to saving the Jews. He had a vision of what he wanted the Jews to be, which the others did not have. And what he wanted them to be was not so bad. He thought that the only culture they had was a religious culture. This is correct. It is the only culture they have. At the same time, he did not want theocracy and despotism of the rabbis.
To pave an ideological way between
theocracy,
the simulation.
Against the simulation was not that easy.
No, he managed it. He did manage it.
I know.
Secular religious culture.
Now, when did your anti-clericalism start?
I don't think it ever started. I don't think I was ever particularly anti-clerical. I mean, I'm only anti-clerical. Well, what do you mean anti-clerical? You mean as far as the Jews are concerned?
Yes, or in general? I'm thinking about that. I mean, you never liked the Jewish religious parties.
No. Simply because I wasn't religious. That's all. I didn't like the Aguda because it was the Aguda. Because they were not Zionists and because they were fanatical. I was repelled by the fanaticism of my generation, my grandparents in Riga. When this is absolutely rigid, particularly my grandfather, my mother's father, we didn't allow her to play the piano because it was forbidden and all that. What was the same thing is? Exactly. And this extreme fanaticism. I was repelled by that and bored by it. I was bored by the synagogue. I did not enjoy going to the synagogue. I didn't mind it too much, but I was terribly bored. The prayers were too long. Ordinary Jewish bourgeois child's reactions is what I had. And the idea of religious Zionism didn't please me because I had no respect for rabbis. I never in my life met a rabbi whom I could deeply respect as a human being. Never. I mean, I liked some and didn't like others. But there was no rabbi to whom I could look up as a person, anywhere.
And you remember it as a reminiscence of a child?
No, I'm telling you that now. It wasn't conscious.
Yes.
I've never asked that question. But I mean, I never wanted to meet a rabbi as such. I met them, I was polite. But no rabbi I ever met seemed to me either intellectually or morally first rate. It's a sad comment, no doubt Harav Cook was. I didn't know him. I liked Harav Herzog. He's such a nice man. You see? And I was pleased to meet him and so on.
Now, and you have never gone through a religious phase?
Well, yes, I must have done. I did, yes. Not a very deep one. I think sometime when I was about 16, was the kind of time when that happens. Leonard Shapiro and I used to go to Stiebel's in London instead of the official Anglo-Jewish affair because we thought the fervor was more genuine. And there was some kind of deep, passionate feeling on the part of these poor Jews. And that made a deep impression on me. And I preferred that to the boring Anglican services of the United Synagogue. So I had a phase of that kind. But even then, I didn't believe in God. I must have prayed in my life, because in moments of crisis, one is, of course, apt to pray. But I wasn't praying to any particular... I've never in my life understood what the word God meant. That's my trouble. Either it's an old man with a long white beard, that I understand, but that I don't believe. Or I don't know what they mean. The idea of some kind of impersonal spirit guides the universe and dictates the Ten Commandments to Moses is meaningless to me and always has been. So I've never been through a deep religious phase and I've never recoiled against it. I've never had either for or against. Religion was never disgusting to me. I didn't mind going to churches. I didn't mind going to mosques. I quite enjoy it. And I go to synagogues now with more pleasure than I did when I was a child, because I like the sense of historical Jewish solidarity. But that's all. And the prayers are known to me, and they have a certain sentimental value. But I don't believe a word.
Now, in this kind of ideas, you never dealt with religious ideas.
No, but I respected them. When Haman and Vico and all these characters who do deal with religious ideas, I felt what they said was absolutely true, that it was a basic element in society, to want to worship and to have a religion. That there are no such thing as a non-religious society. That cannot be. I felt psychologically the need for some kind of religious experience was as basic as the need for artistic experience, for food and drink and shelter and belonging to a group. And therefore I've always accepted it as a perfectly natural human need, which needed to be satisfied. All I objected to was the, so to speak, political disasters that followed from it, or moral bullying. But I've never felt that an atheist society would be intellectually or morally better. That I've never felt. That's why I have no disgust. You see, I don't spit when rabbis are mentioned, as Nehemiah did before his reconversion. Nehemiah really hated priests and rabbis. I never did. I didn't like the Orthodox Church. The Russian priests, no. Because that smelled of pogroms to me. I knew that when they had their formal processions, long essence locks, and the icon, and the long thing, sometimes it ended in beating up the Jews. So I had a certain, quite atavistic fear, and not so much fear, but distaste. So when I see Russian even now, not even bishops, when I see Russian bishops with long essence locks and holy looks, I have a certain reaction. Now the only people I have no objection to mullahs.
No association?
And no association to none to Jesuits, none to Catholic priests. I don't mind them.
You don't mind Jesuits?
No.
I mean Inquisition and this part of
history? No. Not part of my history. The Inquisition, I'm somewhere else. What happened, pogroms in Russia, is part of my past. The Inquisition is long ago. Of course I'm against.
Yeah.
And I claim the French 18th century and Enlightenment. Well, that's abstract to some extent. But I see a Catholic priest now. I don't feel he wants to burn Jews. Because then none of them do, the ones I meet. Of course there are fanatics.
I think in the late 60s...
The Pope is not a pleasing figure to me.
The Pope...
He's not a... at that moment. No, he was a positive figure in Jewish life. But his ideas were obviously not realizable. That is clear.
And we are talking about
the popes, two Catholics. The religion, yes. I must say the thought of the last popes, and of course John the 23rd, is all right, and I don't even hate the present pope, in spite of his somewhat reactionary views, and I'm sure he's got an element of anti-Semitism in him. Like all Poles, they must have. But when one thinks of all those thin-faced popes who preceded him, I have a sort of feeling that
there is something more human.
Not good for Jews. Not good for Jews, the Pope. The Vatican is not, although Lord Weidenfeld is trying to promote Catholic-Jewish relations, I'm not against it, but I have no hope from that court.
He's an interesting Pope. I mean,
certainly.
Modern in his technique and
absolutely. Very exactly. Very handsome and very effective. Very one of the most powerful people in the world. He's restored the papacy to a much higher level than it was before. That's why they're very wise to choose him. From that point of view. Kind of Catholic Weizmann. He's a kind of Catholic Weizmann.
But I mean, I'm coming back to your attitude toward clericalism on the one hand, and in Jewish life, and another problem in another, on the other hand. In the 60s, late 60s, I believe, and the early 70s, you became worried about two different aspects in Jewish life. You became then anti-clerical. I mean, I would get letters from you, letters from you.
Quite about him. Yes, yes.
Secondly, simultaneously, more or less, you became occupied with the problem of the apologetic attitude to Jewish history and the...
Whose part?
I mean, the general, I mean, the history that is being written by scholars is too apologetic and
of whom?
To be done about.
By whom, for example?
I can't remember.
I'm sure I'm anti-apologetic, but I'm sure it's plausible. I just wonder who are you thinking of?
I don't know.
Cecil Roth.
I mean, but I remember you wrote me. Could we find somebody who would write different kind of Jewish history?
Yes, quite so. Exactly, yes.
And it started in the late 60s, and I don't know what background.
Nor do I. No, I don't. All I can tell you is that about the Rabbonim I do remember. Because then, of course, more and more they became influential in Israel. And I thought this is a grave danger to individual liberty, simply.